comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to the show from the music room in the tower of the Steel Eye Media Network Castle, high atop Steel Eye Mountain. Welcome to the show, whoever you may be, wherever you may be. And if it's your very first time to tune in, welcome aboard. We've gotten a lot of email from people since we started doing the video. Saying, why don't you give us a little bit of a tour of your studio? Well, it's a little bit hard to do that, to drag the camera around everywhere because it's so cavernous. And I thought I would just give you a little bit of a taste of sort of what our surroundings are here. So we're up in the tower in the music room of the Steel Eye Media Network mansion or castle. On the top of Steel Eye Mountain, and during the first break, I'll rush down to our regular studio, and maybe as the days go by, I'll give you a little bit of a taste of what some of the other surroundings are here in our cavernous labyrinth of a facility. And that way you'll get to know it a little bit better. It looks a whole lot like the room where John Lennon did that video where he sang Imagine, doesn't it? And but it's not. It's ours. Okay. I want to thank all of our wonderful affiliates that carry this show all across the country and around the world. Thank you for doing that. And we certainly appreciate you. Now, for those of you who are brand new, you need to know that not only are we on the Internet as an Internet radio show, we're on AM, FM, shortwave, and also we have an Internet television feed. And it just keeps growing. And you are why? Because you tell all your friends about the show. And that's an important thing for you to do. Tell all your friends about the show. You've been doing that for 8 years. Let's don't stop now. You've made it happen. We're in 95 countries now, and let's shoot for all of them. There's no reason, if they've got internet access, there's no reason why we shouldn't be in all of the countries of this planet. Now, you need to know also, and some of you who have been listening for a long time need to be reminded that we have a free weekly newsletter. That free weekly newsletter is called the K-Files E-Zine, and you can subscribe by going over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. When you get over there, you'll see a little button with red letters. It says K-Files E-Zine. Just click that and subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. We hate to see you do it, and not too many people ever do. Most people stay with us forever. In fact, some are with us that have been with us right from the beginning, right from when we first started publishing that back in 2000. If you're not getting it, be sure you subscribe because it's a good newsletter. There's always interesting stuff in there about the show, always some interesting articles and links to interesting articles and videos. Now, this last week, I sent out all the links to the videos were to music videos. It's because last week I had a birthday, and that was my birthday party. So I hope you enjoyed those. It's a rather eclectic mix. My guest this evening is James Penniston. He will be with us on the other side of this break. He was the security chief that led the security party out into the woods at the Rendlesham Forest incident. You want to be sure and stay tuned for this whole show. We'll be back right after this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artist from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
Show unique in the galaxy.
We are back, and my guest this evening is James Penniston, and you may be familiar with him already. He's been talking about his experience with what has come to be known as the Rendlesham Forest Incident. He's been talking about that for several years now, and we are greatly privileged to have him with us this evening. James, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. It's great to be on.
Why? Now, you were the chief of security at the RAF Woodbridge. Why has this come to be called Rendlesham Forest instead of the Woodbridge Forest?
Well, the base was RAF Woodbridge, but Rendlesham Forest was the woods that was adjacent to the air base at the time. It stretched about 8 miles. So I guess that's where the name came from.
Okay. Let's go back to... what was it, 19... What year was it, 1994?
It was actually 1980, December 1980.
Okay, 1980. Start with what was your job at the base? Let's sort of get that established first. I know I said chief of security, but what does that entail in as far as you can tell us?
Well, what our job was is to make sure that all the operational Air Force resources were safe on the air base and wouldn't have any type of damage or anything done by terrorists or anything like that. And they would be able to launch in case of war. So that was our primary job, is the weapon storage area and about 110 A-10 aircraft.
Okay, now, whenever you talk about providing security, it's sort of like... you're the guys guarding the guys that guard the rest of us, right?
That's correct. We were the last and the first line of defense for the air base, and it was a unique job over there because it wasn't a single base. It was two bases that were separated all by about 2 miles. That was RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. The primary base was RAF Bentwaters, and the satellite base was RAF Woodbridge.
All right, now, describe for us what has come to be known as the Rendlesham Forest Incident from your perspective, from what you saw.
Okay, I was in charge of security that night, and I received a call from the Central Security Control to rendezvous with the police teams, police 2 and police 3 at the rear gate, which was now become known as Eastgate. And when I arrived out there, we thought we had a possible aircraft bounty. And the patrolmen both told me that they seen this craft go down, and but they didn't see any, they didn't hear no crash, and it looked like a controlled landing. So I went to the entry control point that was nearby. I called it in saying that we have a possible aircraft downing and we need to go ahead and set up, you know, the emergency protocols that we had in place. So Central Security Control then advised me to go ahead and pick a team, go off base for the crash, and set up for emergency response. And when we did that, we I had assembled the team, and this is probably about 5 minutes after the initial call to the East Gate. And we went as far as we could with our jeeps and vehicles, and we started to have some radio difficulty. And so I took one of the patrolmen, Aaron Kabanzak, and I used him for a radio relay. Myself and the senior law enforcement patrolman, John Burroughs, and I did proceed into Rendlesham Forest. As we got closer...
What time of day is this?
This happened about 12:11 hours around midnight on the 26th of December. It was a very dark and crisp night. It was about 30 degrees out. It's the winter in England.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we... go ahead, Kevin. You got a question?
No, I was going to say, so you guys would have been all bundled up for the night to be out in the night air.
No, we're working our third shift. We were on 12-hour shifts because of the holiday schedule. We went in about 10 o'clock at night. We're there till probably 10 in the morning. And, we had went through, at least I had went through all my preliminary stuff before getting called to the East Gate. I mean, I was doing lighting.
Yeah, but I mean, when I say bundled up, I mean, I'm talking about it was, you said it was a crisp night. I suppose you were wearing cold weather gear.
I didn't hear that last part.
I suppose you were wearing cold weather gear.
No, it wasn't that cold. I mean, we had winter jackets on and stuff, but it wasn't that cold. But you could see your breath.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay, and anyway, myself and the other patrolman, when we got to the edge of Rendlesham Forest, it became quite apparent that it wasn't an aircraft crash. And as we further investigated, we found a craft of unknown origin, approximately 50 feet within the tree line. It was... undamaged, at least as far as we could tell. We called in the information to Central Security Control. They told us to complete an investigation on it. We did. We did a 360 around the craft. We took photographs of it. It was on the ground approximately 45 minutes, and all during that time we were in constant control. Communication with Central Security Control. And this was done through Airman Kabanzak, our radio relay. Even though he was relaying our transmissions, we could hear everything back from CSC direct. And so about 45 minutes on the ground, with one of the most unbelievable situations that I've ever encountered. And quite honestly, nothing in my training ever prepared me for something that extreme.
All right. Now, you carried with you a notebook, and I think folks need to know, if they haven't been in police work or security work, almost every agency that you could ever work for requires you to carry a notebook so that you can make notes immediately at the time
so that they will be accurate, and you don't have to rely on your memory later and maybe leave something out. Now, in your notebook, you made some sketches of this craft. Now, could you describe this craft for us?
Yes, you're exactly right about the notebook. We kept detailed notes just so we could make sure we had everything correct for our reports. My notebook had described stuff from the air temperature to the size of the craft to the on the right side of the craft as we approached it. There was etching of some sort. I had written down the symbols that were on the side of the craft, and we also examined, you know, underneath it and looked for, you know, some type of crew compartment. We looked for some kind of exhaust area, intake. We couldn't find anything like that. It was completely smooth to the touch.
What color was it?
Well, that's interesting because it was multiple color as we were outside the tree line, and the closer we got, the bright lights in the coloring started to dissipate. When we got up to the craft, it was just very little light, enough to make a silhouette at night. But it would be more like a black glass, and very, very smooth, and it was warm to the touch too.
Okay, so you actually touched this craft?
Oh, absolutely. We were trying to check underneath it to see if there was any movement. You know, how heavy was it? Was it secure to the ground? Things like that.
Now, when you say you checked underneath it, that would imply it was not sitting on the ground.
Well, it didn't appear to be having any type of landing gear of any kind. Matter of fact, there was open air between the ground and maybe a foot up, foot and a half up on the craft before the fabric of the craft was there. And for some reason, it seemed like it was sitting on something, but there was no landing gear apparent.
All right, now, I found on the internet I don't know if this is a copy of your notebook or maybe you sketched it later or if this is your notebook, but we have three views here, and one of them is a front view, one is a side view, and one is a top view of a triangular craft. Actually, this triangular craft has the angularity of a cockpit portion, although I don't know if it's a cockpit, but that's what it would appear to be from where it's positioned. It has the angularity that we see in the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber. Is that what you saw?
Well, those drawings that you're referring to, I believe, are the ones that we did for the Air Force OSI. And the center of the triangular craft was raised up about a couple feet, but it was very smooth on the angles. And I'm not a very good artist, obviously, so that's why there's a lot of straight lines on that. But it's hard to draw the top side of that craft. That was one of the reasons why I was looking for a crew compartment, an entrance, because it appeared that would be the most likely spot for that.
And what about windows? Were there any windows in this thing?
No, there was none. There wasn't any intakes for the engines, or there was no openings for engines to be located. It was completely smooth all the way around the craft, underneath and on the sides. There was no openings at all.
Now in the top view, it appears that the all the sides are straight. But when we look at the front view, it looks like that back edge is curved. So which was it? Was it straight across or was it curved?
It was straight all the way around. I'm not sure what drawings you have. I don't know if they're even my drawings. So, you know, I know I did some for OSI afterwards, but are the drawings dated or?
It's so small, it's hard for me to read. It's either the 27th or 29th of December 1980, and it's signed by you.
Those are it, yeah. Those are the ones we did for OSI.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was straight all the way around. I mean, it was a complete triangle. But it did have some height to it. I mean, the craft measured about 6.5, 7 feet high. And it was approximately probably 9 feet long.
So this was not a gigantic craft.
No, it was very small. I mean, if, you know, if I compared it to... say an F-15 or something like that was half the size of that. A lot, it was very small.
Did it would it appear to have been large enough for a human to pilot?
I couldn't. No, I didn't think it was. I thought it was just a little bit too cramped for any type of a pilot. So I thought it might have been automated.
What we call a UAV.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, did at any point did you have any contact with any extraterrestrial beings there?
Oh, absolutely not. We had a craft that was on the ground for 45 minutes. I did ascertain that after about 10 minutes, of course, by checking out the craft and things like that, I determined it was non-hostile because of the resources that we had in base. I had to get that information back to our control center as soon as possible. So about 10 minutes in the investigation, I did relay that information back to the control center. I felt that it was non-hostile.
And what made you come to that conclusion?
It didn't react to anything during the investigation, me touching it, me walking around it, trying to shake it. I mean... it didn't react to any of that.
What did it feel like when you touched it?
It felt warm to the touch. It felt like, if you could describe, it felt like metal, but it was the smoothest metal I've ever touched. But it was warm to my touch. Of course, the air temperature was about 30, 32 degrees. But I'd say the fabric of that felt like 60, 65 degrees. It felt warm.
Did any part of it feel warmer than any other part, perhaps giving you a clue as to where its power unit may be?
No, the temperature was uniform throughout the craft, and the front portion, what I call the front, that's the one I approached, to the rear of it. That was all uniform as far as the temperature.
All right, so there are two of you that see it. And what about your guy that you left for a radio relay? Did he ever see this thing?
Yes, he did. He was only about, I would say, probably about 100, 150 feet away. So, because, you know, everybody's seen it on takeoff, I mean, including the patrolman that was nearby. We had an entire, we had 25 patrolmen on Woodbridge at the time, and we had another 50 patrolmen over at RAF Bentwaters, and all those security personnel watched it took off, or taken off.
So, right now, when it took off, was it a surprise to you that it took off, or did you know that something was up? I mean, could you tell that it was powering up to leave?
Absolutely, we knew it was powering up because the intensity of lights went from dim to started to go bright, and that's when myself and Burroughs took a defensive position away from it, and it got even brighter. It then started to lift up off the forest floor, maybe 5 feet, 6 feet, sort of moved back in between the trees a little bit, and then it went up to the top of the trees, which is about, you know, 75 feet. It hovered there momentarily, and gone literally in a blink of an eye.
When you say it was gone in the blink of an eye, did it travel laterally, or did it travel straight up or in what direction?
I couldn't see it depart. When it went to the top of the trees, I could not see it depart. It was that fast. I mean, and anything moving that fast, Kevin, you'd have some type of air displacement of some kind. You'd have sonic booms. You'd have something like that. There was no air displacement at all. Air being moved or anything like that. It was very strange.
I read an article last week where there are scientists who say that it is possible to generate an anti-gravity beam in front of a ship if that ship were traveling at a substantial fraction of the speed of light, and that this would very likely mitigate any type of sonic boom because there would be it's not disturbing anything in front of it.
Well, I don't know about all that. All I know is that the technology that we have, the U.S. Air Force, and anything in the James Book of aircraft cannot. We don't have engines that don't make no sound. We don't have aircraft that can take off, lift off the ground without air displacement. We don't have aircraft that can hover without sound and air displacement, and then take off at a rate of speed that literally is a blink of an eye. So where would that be? I don't know. It's fast. I mean, 6,000, 10,000.
We're into a break, and we'll come back with more from James Peniston right after this, folks. Don't go away.
The ones that left us much too soon. In the summer, with a cheer and a smile. And I am feeling happy now for just being.
Welcome back. My guest this evening is James Penniston. And when we went away for break, you were describing the fact that this thing just in every way did not match anything that we're aware of our U.S. Air Force having.
That's correct. You know, our job, or at least my job at the time, was to be able to identify any unknown aircraft. I mean, either through silhouettes or that. We routinely went and practiced that. We trained on it monthly. I mean, we were familiar with all Warsaw Pact aircraft, NATO, friendly forces. I mean, there just wasn't an aircraft at that time, nor today, that that I know of that can maneuver and have those type of physical properties.
All right. Now, as it began to power up, you and the guy that was with you took a defensive position. I guess, what does that mean? You got behind something?
Well, we got behind a small berm of ground that was adjacent to the craft. Because I just wasn't sure what was going to go, what was going on.
How long did it take to power up?
Well, how long what, Kevin?
How long did it take for it to power up?
20 seconds, 15.
It didn't take long at all.
This is with no sound. This is only light, though. There's no sound. You got to remember that. It was just sound, or no sound, just light. No, it didn't take long at all for the light to start filling in the fabric of that craft. I mean, it got bright.
Now, you said this thing was metal, but it was the smoothest metal you ever touched. After touching this, as the days went by, did you experience any kind of, like, radiation burns or anything like that?
Well, myself and Emma Burles, actually John and I talked in depth about 30 days ago. We had a very good, several conversations together. And it's unique because we haven't talked about the incident since it happened. So that was the first time. And he's suffering, well, we were all suffering from the same type of ailments, excuse me, that we were sort of astonished that we had the same type of inflictions. Within 2 months, I had a lot of dizziness and that. Went in for and they diagnosed this as Meniere's disease, but it was a problem in my middle ear. John has the same problem. He also has some other medical problems I can't talk about, but they're from the incident itself. Actually, right now, we decided, both of us, to file VA claims on it because of the radiation. The thing that drove the radiation, I'll tell you what, I was given, when I went to Washington, D.C. last November for the press conference, the national press conference, I met Nick Pope. And Nick Pope gave me a formerly classified document from the Ministry of Defense that basically said that they conducted their own investigation and they found that the radiation levels were extremely high out there, and they elected not to tell the U.S. Air Force about it at that time. So I got that letter and I talked to John about it, and we're working that because we are suffering from that type of exposure, unfortunately.
All right, now, why did the Ministry of Defense choose not to tell the U.S. Air Force when they found that radiation?
Well, everything's compartmentalized, I guess. I'm not really sure. I'm going to guess on that one. I don't know the answer to that. I think maybe Nick Pope would be probably better to ask that question to. I mean, I can only guess. I think it's because It was routine for us to have U.S. documents that weren't releasable to the U.K. We kept it within U.S. channels. I would imagine they were similar as us. They had documents that they wouldn't release either.
All right. Now, what about your radio relay man? Did he suffer from any kind of radiation burns?
Not that I know of. Kabanzak was at least 100 feet away, 150 feet. But that's he could. I don't know. As far as I know, he hasn't. But that'd be a nice, a good question probably to ask him.
When this craft took off and you're behind a small berm near the craft, how near is it?
20 feet.
About 20 feet.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, you said that everybody on the base saw the thing take off, right?
They seen it momentarily hover over the tree line, and then they seen it take off away from the Woodbridge Air Base. They had a phenomenal rate of speed.
Now, the next day after all of this happened, and of course, this is happening actually in the early morning hours, and just after midnight. About 11 minutes after midnight is when the incident begins, as far as your involvement in it.
Yeah, that's what's in my logbook.
Yeah,
and then the takeoff was probably somewhere around 2:40.
Okay, 2:40. Okay, well, now if it's on the ground for 45 minutes, it would be 12:56.
Takes a while to get out there.
I see.
You have to smell our vehicle.
I see. I understand. Okay, I didn't account for the travel time. So it's about 2:40 in the morning. We're not. It's almost 3:00. We're not that far from sunrise. At that point, and when the sun comes up, what are people on the base talking about? Is anybody talking about all of this?
Well, when we got back, to our patrols at the East Gate, the flight sergeant and several patrols were there. They were just, we didn't talk, no one talked. Just that. They told us that we've been relieved. They want us back at the control center immediately. And so we went back to the control center. Didn't talk to anybody in the vehicle. We didn't talk between ourselves. Got back to the control center, and we were debriefed by our flight security officer. The first thing that happened when I got off the vehicle at the security control is I met Sergeant Chandler. He was... He's our flight sergeant for RF Bentwaters. And I says to Chandler, I says, you wouldn't believe what happened out there. And he says, we believe it. He said, we could see it from here. I said, okay. He says, and then he said, the chef commander wants to talk to both myself and Ellen Burroughs. So we went and got debriefed by him.
All right. He debriefed you. Was that the first and last debriefing, or did you go through some more?
No, it was the first in several briefings that we had to do debriefings. His was pretty basic, and I tell you what, Burroughs and I, we kept it fairly sanitized as much as we could without sounding, completely just crazy to the guy. And he sat there and he tapped his pencil and he was listening to us intently. And he said, gentlemen, he says, the Air Force quit investigating UFOs in 1969. He says, there's no way to report this.
Don't even report it, huh?
He says, some things are best done, left alone. And so, and actually that was going to be we were going to go with that order. And, of course, the other part's history with Colonel Hall, because what are the chances of the craft coming back 3 days later? And that's when Colonel Hawk got involved.
Now, did he actually see the craft on the ground?
I don't believe he did. I don't believe he's seen it on the ground. I think his was in the air. But they did leave impressions, too. There were several locations, but they were off of the Woodbridge base.
Now, you were not going to report it because that's what you'd been told. Some things are just better left unreported. So that's what you were going to do. But you ended up reporting it. Why?
We reported it when we came back in, and we were told not to do that. Then Colonel Halt called, a couple of days later, Colonel Halt called me to his office, and he played his tape for me. And I said, how can that be? I said, Colonel, how can we have two incidents like this? He says, well, I believe you. He says, I was out to debunk it. He says, and I got into a situation I cannot explain either. And so then after that was a series of debriefings from OSI and others.
Now, they told you after your talk with OSI that this was to be considered secret.
Top secret.
Top secret. And then at some point, you decided to talk about this. How does that work? I mean, when you began to talk about it, were you afraid that you were going to get into trouble?
I never did talk about it. I didn't talk about it until, as a matter of fact, I've been on the base. I wouldn't talk about it right after the incident. I mean, the 3 years after that, I was at the base. I was even at another base 10 years later. It came back up. I never discussed it. But Colonel Halt, when he retired, I think, a couple years before I did. And when he retired, he specifically asked, we sent a paper on classified information that we have obtained, you know, have knowledge of during our service time. And he asked if, why that wasn't on there about the incident at Bentwaters. And he said that they said it never happened. There's nothing to be classified. So when I did my debriefing for exiting the Air Force, I had the same form to go ahead and sign, saying what we could discuss and what we can't discuss. And that was it on there. I asked the same question. And they said there's no record of anything ever happening out there. It was fine. So
if it's not on the list, you can talk about it.
So we can talk about it, that's right.
And I guess the plan was that if you guys ever talked about it, they would simply deny that it happened and say we have no record of it. And the problem with that, the fly in the ointment, is that Nick Pope and the Ministry of Defense came back out and said, yeah, it did happen. And Lord Hale Norton led an investigation from the House of Lords on this thing. And so there was no denying it then.
They weren't expecting that part. Yeah, they weren't expecting that part at all. And I'll tell you what's very interesting with the Air Force Information Office at the Pentagon. In 94, I sat at their office, asked what happened there at Bentwaters, Woodbridge, and they said that nothing of significance, defense significance happened there. Said possible aircraft crash. And this latest one I got, because I sent like eight of them off over the years, and I just sent one last fall, and that was interesting too. And they said that nothing happened there on that date. And they said, matter of fact, their office wasn't authorized to talk about it. They sent me to headquarters, U Safety Information Officer, and they sent me a letter back, and they said, we don't have any information on that. You'd have to talk to Third Air Force, who works for headquarters USAV. So I get another letter from Third Air Force in England, and they say they don't have no information on it. They don't know nothing about it. You'd have to talk to Washington.
All right, we'll find out what Washington said when we come back from this break. More with James Peniston on the other side, folks, right after this. Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet? No? Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today. Welcome back. My guest this evening is James Peniston, and he's telling us about his more than amazing experience whenever he led the security team into the Rendlesham Forest looking for whatever it was that had been seen going down in the Rendlesham Forest. And when we went away for break, you were telling us about this long chain of trying to track down whatever information there was on it, and you said you finally they referred you to Washington. So what happened then?
Washington said that I got a lot of text from Washington, and they said that there is no record of anything happening on that date. So
now, when you say Washington, who are you talking about? The Pentagon?
Mm-hmm. That's where I got the correspondence back from. Where I started from. You know, I started last year with the Pentagon, and they went all the way through USAFE, headquarters Europe, And then the 3rd Air Force, they went back finally to Washington, and they just said that nothing happened on that date. You know, but I got letters to say different, you know, that they change every few years. The Air Force has a different response to it. It doesn't surprise me. I mean...
And you have the British Ministry of Defense file on it. They verified something happened, right?
Well, yeah, they sure did. Everything's documented from the British side. And I'll tell you what, Nick Pope, when I talked to him in Washington, he apologized for the British government and the Queen, apology from them, saying that they should have told us about the radiation levels. So, and I accepted the apology. He's sort of restricted, I think, on what he can say, too. I don't know. I don't think he can tell everything.
Well, they do not have the same freedom of speech that we have. They simply
Correct.
Do not. And although ours has been much curtailed over the past 20 years or so, it's there's still a great deal more latitude than they have. They have, what do they call it, the Official Secrets Act?
The Official Secrets Act. Yeah,
yeah.
They'll put you in jail. Yeah, they'll imprison you for leaking any type of information out like that. So you have to be careful. I understand that.
All right. Now, you have talked with the other airman that was with you. What is his name? Airman what?
John Burroughs.
John Burroughs.
I talked to him recently about it. Yeah, he was on the West Coast, and he was back on vacation, and I got a chance to talk to him in depth, and we're planning on doing some research ourselves that's between us that we're going to look at further. We have some dissimilarities, not much, but minor, at the incident between him and I. But the interesting thing is, in 1991, he got transgressional hypnosis done, and it was taped. And then in 1994, I had the same thing, transgressional hypnosis done, and it was taped. And what was interesting about it is that we found out last month that everything on the transgressional hypnosis is identical. It doesn't vary one iota, which is really interesting.
All right. Now, did he keep a notebook of this thing, too, or just you?
It was a security-related matter. He was law enforcement, so I don't believe he did. I know that he had, he normally kept notes, too, but I think that was more for law enforcement patrolling.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, in your notes, in your notebook, you drew or sketched the letters that you saw etched on the side of this thing, or the symbols.
Right.
I called it letters, but I think you said symbols that were etched on the side.
Right.
Now, do you still have your notebook?
I still have the book, and matter of fact, we're in the middle of doing a Out of the Blue movie, which is a documentary about this, and James Fox is doing this. And he has gotten some of this stuff by experts, I guess, throughout the world, mainly England, that are looking at this for deciphering what these symbols actually mean. And
now, do they look like letters, or do they look like hieroglyphics, or what?
It's pictorial. It looks like pictorial to me. Yes, that's what I would call it.
And did any of it look familiar to you? Is there anything in it where you say, well, you know, that looks like this over here I've seen?
No, nothing. And, you know, since then I've went through, you know, old texts and books and, you know, Sumerian writing. I've looked at everything, and nothing is similar to it.
Was there anything on this craft that looked to you like an emblem? You know, like on our aircraft, there's depending on which service, but there's a blue circle with a star, you know.
Well, and, you know, that was interesting. In the middle of the symbols was a round symbol that measured probably about 4 or 5 inches wide, and it was another triangle with a couple other circles in there, and that looked like some type of marking or something like that. But it wasn't placed at the size or where we usually would place those type of markings. We placed our markings underneath the craft and at the tail section and stuff like that, but wasn't the case.
Now, since this thing was a triangle, was there any way for you to tell what was the front of the craft?
No, I really don't know what the front of the craft was. I just used the front for my reference as the one I approached from. But it looked identical. It didn't make any difference whether you were standing on one side or another side. They all looked the same, except for the one side that had the symbols on it.
All right. Now, the symbols. When we look at the sketch you made, and I believe you said these were the sketches you made for OSI, if we look at the side view, there is along the side near the front of that a darkened area. Is that where the symbols would have been?
Yes, that's where they were.
What is that underneath the craft? I mean, on that, looking at that side view, there is a rectangular portion drawn underneath that. It looks almost like a wing coming out. What is that?
I know that everything was curved down there, and I'm not a very good artist. So if you see stuff that looks very straight and like it would be up in the air, like 2 feet, you gotta understand that these things were actually, it was curved. If there was height involved, there was curving to that height.
Okay. Now, the thickness of this craft, when you said it was about 6 feet tall, are you including the height of what would appear to be a canopy?
Correct.
Okay. Without that canopy, how thick was the craft?
2 feet, 2.5 feet.
Very thin, then.
Yes. And, it was later determined through testing, because of the ground temperature, the impressions in the ground, what it have to be for something to sink in at that temperature. They figured it would be something like, 20 to 25 tons, which is extremely light aircraft. F-15 weighs something like 30 tons, So it was very light.
Now, we're just about to this next break, but the symbols appear only on one side of it. Is that correct?
Correct. And they tuned up toward the front of one of the triangular, at what I consider the front. It was on the right side as I approached it. But like you said, I don't know where the front was. That was just the reference point that I used.
Now, were they painted on, or were they etched into the material, or how were they on there?
The best way to describe it is etching. They were in the fabric of the metal itself. It was not painted or nothing like that.
All right. We are maybe 30 seconds now from break. And when we come back from this break, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to open up the telephone line for you. I'll put the telephone number on the screen as usual, and I need to tell you that although we had planned to bring Skype online again tonight, we ran into a problem, and that is we were minus one patch cord. And so we'll have to obtain that and try to bring Skype back online tomorrow, all right? I apologize for that, but hey, what can I do? I got to have that cord. All right, we'll be back right after these messages, and we will continue talking with James Penniston. And then we'll take your calls and your comments. Don't go away.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith, and we are talking with James Peniston, who was the chief of security, or the security chief, for RAF Woodbridge at the time of the Rendlesham Forest incident back in 1980. James,
let's go straight to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Ryan in Washington.
Yeah, Ryan.
Kevin, you're on a roll, man.
How so?
You're on a roll. One of the things that's always fascinating about this case is the symbols that, and I want to commend you for taking the time to take out your notepad and draw the symbols off the side of this thing. The thing about these symbols that I've always been fascinated with is you can clearly make out what appears to be a human being. There, you can clearly see two legs, two arms, and a head.
You mean in the symbols?
I wanted to ask you, can you go through when you drew these? Were you standing there when you drew these symbols, and how much time did you have? I think everybody understands that you only had so much time, but I just want to thank you for stopping and drawing these symbols, or did you do them later?
Okay, how about that, James? When you drew those symbols into your notebook, was it right then while you were looking at them, or later?
Oh, that was done right then at the moment. We had 45 minutes while I was on the ground, and as we were doing the checks around, when I got to the symbol area, I immediately started drawing them down on the paper. And the interesting thing about the notebook, I think it's on one of the websites or on the internet somewhere. If you look at it, you can see my writing progressively get more erratic and shaky. And by the time I got to the symbols, I was pretty I was pretty shook up. I was trying to keep calm. I knew that this was something that had to be done correctly and recorded correctly.
Yeah.
And I did my best at that.
All right, let's go back to the phone. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hey, Terry.
Hey, good. I have a question along them symbols, too. You asked him whether they were, like, stenciled on or they were kind of, like, engraved. I was wondering, did he fill them? Did he fill them with his hands or impregnated into the material?
What about that, James? Do you feel it with your hand or was it impregnated into the material?
The symbols were etched into the material of the fabric of the craft, but I did run my hand across them, and it was fine machining, it was. I mean, it was definitely...
But you could feel the texture of the etching?
Oh, absolutely, from the smoothness of the skin of the craft to where the symbols was. The symbols actually were rough.
All right.
Rough to touch, anyway.
Yeah. Any idea on your part, any idea at all now as you think about this as to what those symbols might mean?
We think it's mathematical. We're not sure. We think it's a different type of, definitely a different kind of language, but I think I have to sort of hold off on saying what it is. We have an idea, and it's being researched right now. But I think you'd be fascinated to find out what exactly the deciphering so far has, they came up with.
All right.
But I'm just out of liberty to say anything right now.
All right. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey in Atlanta.
Hi, Trey.
Hi. Look, I want to thank Mr. Pinson for coming on and say it's exciting to hear that they might make a movie about the incident. And I want to make a couple comments and then ask your opinion on something, Mr. Pinson. I want to ask you about anything that happened that night. I want to make a comment saying I think it sounds like it possibly is a disclosure. This happened in 1980, you said, in the documentary. It's from 2003, so that's 23 years later after the incident, which you said you had to sign non-disclosure, you wouldn't talk about it, secret deal. And also, the documentary was it didn't have Jonathan Frakes, no offense to him, or Roger Moore hosting it. It had Bryant Gumbel hosting it, along with, he also did Kexburg. In your opinion, Mr. Peniston, do you think the fact that when you asked about this and they said, oh, since it didn't happen, you can, you know, I guess you can talk about it, you know, considering you had to sign that deal, do you think this is just another step in disclosure?
What was the last part of that?
Do you think this, the fact they, when they had you sign for all the stuff that you would keep secret, this was not on there. Do you think do you think that this is just another step in disclosure?
I don't really know the answer to that. I suppose you could derive that out of it. The 2003 documentary he's talking about with the MPH Entertainment did with Sci-Fi. It was a good one, but we have a pure bones, no bones documentary that'll be out next month or the month after, I think in October. That is probably, it will be the definitive answer on the Rendlesham Forest incident. And I want you to know that we don't have no gain from this at all, anybody that's involved. I mean, there's no financial gain for us or nothing like that. It's purely to get the information out.
Well, I think that's a good thing. But at the same time, I want to say to the audience, you know, for those of you who criticize anyone who wants to earn a living for the time they spent getting that information to you, why don't you try it? You go ahead and try spending the bucks out of your pocket to make a documentary and spend the 6 months to a year that it takes and no income and see how you could feed your family and pay your bills. I admire you if you know, you say that there's, you're not going to get any financial gain out of this, but look, the people that bring you information, folks, are digging into their pockets to do it, and so when they earn something as a result of doing it, you're simply filling the pocket back that emptied to bring you the information. And there's not a thing in the world wrong or immoral with someone earning some money out of a project where they've brought us the information like this. And I hear that all the time, and I think it's important that you understand that a lot of these folks actually go broke, bankrupt, to get you the information. And then when you bellyache and moan because, well, they're just in it for the bucks, you know, it's insane. Just insane.
We spent a lot of money, Kevin. I know, trying, you know, going around the country, different places, different projects. Yeah, we've all spent a lot of our own money out of it. But I think it's important that this information gets out because I do believe that that this will also aid in the U.S. government releasing files that they have, or we know they have classified files. They need to declassify them. They need to release the information. We've discussed this stuff between ourselves in detail about how, why they wouldn't want this information out. We pretty much come to consensus that, you know, if you do 50 years of lies, it's pretty hard to come out and say, well, it was a lie. So, we think that maybe that would be their motive. We don't know. The part about panic, the part about stuff like that is just erroneous. I think the American people are very intelligent, and I think they can figure that kind of stuff out for themselves.
Well, one of the things, Jim, that I say all the time, and those of you who have heard me say it now for about, you know, the millionth time, pardon me as I say it a million and one, but I say all the time that, look, we understand that the military and the intelligence guys, from time to time, they need a cover story. And there are reasons why they need to use a cover story. And I always say, but for God's sake, get better script writers. Get somebody that can write you a cover story that's at least plausible. And now, having said that, that's leading up to my response to what you just said about it's hard to admit to 50 years of lies. You know what? This would work. And if any of those guys are listening, believe me, guys, this will work. Here it is. You ready? I'm going to write your script for you. Here it is. There was a time, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the story. There was a time, ladies and gentlemen, when we were so concerned about this, and we didn't know what it was, and we needed to keep it covered while we investigated. The need for keeping it covered has passed. And so today, we can disclose to you what we know. That'll work.
It'll work.
What, you think so, Jim?
Yeah, I do believe that will work. Matter of fact, I got to go back to the national press conference back in November of 07. When we went there, we met with another 14, 15 people from around the world, military officers and people that were in the space agencies and stuff like that. And they all had similar incidents that we had. And the purpose behind that was to go ahead, and I see there are other countries, they have no problem releasing information except for the United States. But the reason is we want to have a full disclosure done. We know that something significant happened in 1980, something so out of the ordinary that it has changed our lives forever, the people that were involved. And we think the United States government just needs to come clean on it. I don't think we're asking for too much for the Pentagon to make sure that we get documents that are declassified now and just have a full disclosure. We know that classified reports went up. You know, they went up to headquarters UCP, they went up to the Pentagon. General Gabriel, the four-star general is in charge of Air Force, all the Air Forces in Europe, U.S. Air Forces. He came down to RAF Bentwaters within a week or two, a week. Information was passed on to him and material was passed on to him. We know that was all done. I mean, there's so much evidence with this incident that it's overwhelming.
Yeah, and really, in the current atmosphere, the current climate related to UFOs, even this event, you know, where they said it didn't happen, they could come out now and say it was necessary for us to keep it covered while we tried to get a handle on this, while we tried to investigate it. And now we feel the time has come where it's no longer necessary to keep it covered. And here's what we know about it. And, you know, I think they underestimate the American people. I think they underestimate us when they think we won't understand.
No, I think you're right. I think that's exactly what should be said, and it'd be over with then. And that's all they have to do. I mean, we're not sure what it is. We're not sure what they are. They can say all that. I mean, there's no crime in not knowing. We've been asked, myself and Colonel Halt and the other people that are involved out there, most recently, a documentary I did, he said, if there's one thing you could have changed about that incident on the investigation, or what would you have done? I said, well, I had a choice of volunteering for the Christmas schedule or working the New Year's schedule. And I think I would have volunteered for the New Year's schedule and missed the whole thing.
You really would rather have missed it? You would rather?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you understand the personal turmoil that has caused by this. I mean, this is a lot to live with. You know, it is. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind what we've seen was not created on this planet. We know that.
All right,
we know for certain.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio again.
Yeah, Terry.
I think we're on a dead-end street. I think we have so much information out there that unless the people themselves worldwide take control of their governments and, like, demand the information from the Library of Congress, demand the 50 miles
of books that's in the Vatican, access to this information that only the few see, we're going to get nowhere. I mean, there's so much information out there right now that's at our fingertips, you know, and we're, you know, grasping at straws.
Well, let me tell you what it's going to take.
Pardon me?
Based on the show we did with Robert Collins, remember that? And he about the book called Exempt from Disclosure?
Yes.
Based on what he has written, provided that that is accurate, and I think it is, it's very well documented, the reason they are exempt from disclosure is a is an executive order. In other words, an order from the president, and I believe it was Truman. And even that order is so classified they won't release the text of the order. Okay, so assuming that this exempt from disclosure thing is predicated upon an executive order, it would only take an executive order rescinding that original executive order. That's all it takes. And so a president could sign an executive order canceling the original exemption from disclosure and ordering disclosure to happen. Isn't that simple? Isn't that easy?
I think it's proven in the past what happens to presidents that feel along that line.
If they do it and they publish it the same day that they sign the order and they publish it in the newspapers, it's got to be done.
Yeah, I think people's going to have to just demand and suspend our Congress and stuff, you know, and take our government back.
Well, let me ask you this. All these years when people have been demanding, and even congressmen have demanded, and even a senator that was also an Air Force general demanded, nothing happened.
Yeah, because it's powers that's underneath. That's why I say that the people we go to have no power, you know, so we're going to have to be the power, you know, and actually take back, you know, and, you know, accommodate these information ourselves.
Well, the secrecy, apparently, based on Robert Collins' research, is predicated upon an executive order. And so if that is its basis of power, that and only that can cure it.
Yeah. Well, I think Congress and stuff has lost all their authority. And like I say, only the people literally marching on Washington and literally flushing the toilet is going to ever bring this country back to...
You don't have to, you know, I understand what you're saying, but you don't have to march on Washington. You just go to the polls and vote for anyone who hasn't run before.
Yeah, that's another long story in itself.
Yeah, as long as we keep doing the same thing, as long as we keep doing the same thing and expect different results, we are living the definition of insanity.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
What do you think, James?
You know, I think we need to have a full disclosure, but I'll disagree a little bit. I think there are many senators that are actually sympathetic to release of this information.
But they can't. They can't get it done as long as there's an executive order in place that demands secrecy.
We had off the record talk, you know, in Washington and in New York with them, and off the record, they're sympathetic, and there's a reason why they're sympathetic to it. It's because they can't talk about it, and they understand that. These questions have to be answered. They know that this information needs to be released.
But do they have the power to release it?
They don't have the power.
Yeah.
It's, I agree with was it Collins? You're talking about the Apollo astronaut, was it?
No. Robert Collins is a researcher and author, and he has researched, I mean, just miles and piles of Freedom of Information documents, and he says in his book that they are exempt from disclosure because of an executive order issued by Harry Truman. And so long as that's in place, so long as that executive order's in place, they do have the right to and the power of secrecy. But if I'm saying, assuming that's the case, it only takes another executive order to cancel that.
I understand that. But I think a good person I was thinking of on it, because I've heard him talk about it before, is Edgar Mitchell. And he is an Apollo 14 or 13 astronaut. And he has his own story. And he's only recently been coming out with information about that, too. So.
Yeah, he was here on the show not last week, the week before. And really provided some, I think, some great insight into the whole disclosure thing. And, you know, he's just so matter of fact about it. And, you know, he was quoted in a newspaper article, interview with an ABC reporter, and he really kind of gave the reporter a rough ride. And he said, you know, it amazes me. I've been talking. He said, this is a quote. He said, I've been saying these same damn words for 10 years, and now all of a sudden it's international news. We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. More with your telephone calls. The telephone number is 1-623-581-5148. If you have a question or a comment, here's the time when we come back from this break.
Stay at the back of this room.
We are back. It's the Kevin Smith Show, and I am your host, Kevin Smith. The telephone number is 1-623-581-5148. My guest this evening, James Penniston, who was the security chief for RAF Woodbridge, which was one of the air bases right there at the Rendlesham Forest incident. The other one was called Bentwaters. And I believe they sat across the woods from each other, didn't they?
Yes, they were separated by about 3 miles of Rendlesham Forest in between them.
One of the theories that has come out by some of these debunkers is that what you guys really were seeing was light from the lighthouse, which is over on the coast, and that would be east of Woodbridge, would it not?
That's correct.
Is that possible?
Not at my location. My location, the White House is not visible. See, there's two locations. The one that happened 3 nights later with Colonel Hall, you could observe the White House if you wanted to the left where he was at. But, Colonel Hall was a forward air controller in Vietnam. I mean, he knows the difference between lighthouses and aircraft, and it's...
Well, there is another problem with that lighthouse theory, and that is that the lighthouse keeper, and I think also the Ministry of Defense looked into that over in England, said that because there are houses back that direction, not many, but some, and because the light needs to be concentrated seaward, there is a shield on the back side of the lighthouse so that when it sweeps around, that light does not get out of the lighthouse. It doesn't. It's not shining toward anything out there. It's only shining toward the ocean.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never knew that, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think these debunkers. I think that if they're we encourage people to debunk. This, if they can, that's fine. We don't have a problem with it. But, I think they're causing more harm than good with it. They're misleading, by saying stuff like that. That is not what's going on. This is not about lights in the sky. I mean, this is about a craft that landed in a woods and took with control landing and a control takeoff. And my God, we were the largest tactical fighter wing in the United States Air Force at the time. We had resources there that were for the, if there was a future war, it was going to be fought with the help of that dual base there, and it would have been done effectively. And our concern there was the resources on that base, are they in jeopardy? And this has really, I don't know, 97%. Of UFOs that are reported are explainable. We know that. The 3%, that is what concerns us from Bentwaters and Woodbridge, and not the 97%, because you can't identify a SR-71 that's in flight at night and it's glowing and it looks triangular and stuff like that. We know that kind of stuff. We know aircraft.
Now, you said earlier that there's not a doubt in your mind that this thing is extraterrestrial. It's not manufactured on this planet. Why? Why is there no doubt in your mind?
We cannot replicate the technology today. That technology, guessing, being conservative, is 200-300, if not 1,000 years, in the future. I mean,
isn't it true, though, that the true state of our technology is very far advanced from the technology that's actually deployed now, so that it might be possible that we have a craft that uses some type of propulsion system that's totally silent, and that there's no exhaust? Isn't that possible?
I guess anything's possible, but I tell you what, And in the 1980, it's for sure it wasn't possible. It's not possible today. An engine has to create some type of noise. The air displacement is probably the biggest problem. There's just no way that a craft can, you know, even a Harrier, it takes off, it's pushing air all over the place, and then it goes ahead and launches for flight. You're going to hear sonic booms and everything else. I mean, there's just no way that we can create a craft that does that right now. We don't have the technology to do that.
Now, when you saw this craft, it was not in the same location as what Colonel Halt went out looking for, was it?
Right. We only became aware of that in 2003.
What part of Rendlesham Forest was it in? The one that you went out and saw?
Where I went was adjacent to the East Gate, going more toward Bentwaters. The one for Colonel Halt was up at the south end of the runway, about a quarter mile off of that. And they're opposite directions, actually. But here's the interesting thing. The reason we didn't discover this until 2003, because we used basic reference points, a farmhouse. Well, there's a farmhouse at both locations. The other thing is when Carl Hall's team measured the indentions in the ground and the actual spacing of the indentions, they measured exactly the same size as the one that we measured. So, you know, they're identical that way. So we had no reason to believe that there was other than more than one site.
All right.
But 2003, when we both were there for the first time since then, and I said, let's go, we're going to go to the site. I said, let's get going. He says, where are you going? I said, to the site. He says, over here. I said, no, it's not, it's over here. That's when we discovered there were two locations.
So I'm trying to understand this now. You're saying that there were two different locations. Are you saying two different locations for, in other words, one location that you went to and one that Colonel Halt went to are two different locations on the same night you went out?
No, there's two locations. The night I went out is one location where one had landed, a craft of unknown origin, and then the night that Colonel Halt went out, another landing took place, and they're two separate incidents. But they're identical craft because the indentions in the ground are identical.
I find it really puzzling that there were indentations in the ground, and yet you guys didn't see any supports, any landing gear on this craft.
Well, all you could see underneath there was light. We could see the indentions in the ground, I mean, but we couldn't see anything causing it. It was very odd.
And the estimates are that it weighed about 25 tons. Would that be the estimate also for Colonel Halt's event?
Yes, all the information is identical. I mean, the size of the pods, everything. Everything's identical.
All right, let's talk about those symbols again for just a moment. You said that there are people working on these symbols to decipher them, to decode them, if you will, and that there has been some progress, I think you said, in this. In what you have seen of the deciphered message or deciphered symbols, was there anything that was surprising or shocking to you in what you've seen deciphered?
Yes, it confirms that it was extraterrestrial. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Does it indicate where the craft may have come from?
Yes.
And if it indicates where the craft may have come from, is it from some place that we know about?
Yes, that's correct.
So if it's some place that we know about, do you know if in the world of UFO secrecy, Do you know if they already knew that that place was an inhabited place?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know, Kevin. But this is progressing. Hopefully we'll have it out, the new documentary, in October, November. And I'm hoping James Fox does a wonderful job of making that documentary. And I know he will. And hopefully you'll have that type of information in there. So it could go out and be released to the public.
All right. Now, it was your impression that this thing was, that this craft was unmanned. Or I guess we would say unbeinged. It had no living being inside it piloting it. That was your impression, right?
Right. I mean, we know how much room a 6-foot man needs to have for a crew compartment. I mean, and then have the ability to have engines and mechanics to make it, you know, take off. It's a very cramped space. Very.
Okay. Provided that it's not. Provided that there's no being in there, that's no pilot in there, then we're talking about a vehicle that is flown remotely, or perhaps has a onboard program that's flying it. And generally, we would think of this then as a probe. And
Correct.
Probes are used to gather intelligence, gather information.
Yes, and you know we've pretty much come up that they do have a certain interest throughout the bona fide sightings that we were talking about in Washington. They all had certain things in common that they were where they appeared, and it turns out that most of the unexplainable phenomena like that occurs around these type of resources.
All right. Now, provided that this UFO was a probe, and provided that it follows what you just said, that they have an interest in these type of places, wouldn't that be of some concern to the military?
I would think that's what the concern is about, yes. I think that would be their concern. Yes.
Now, as a military man, you retired from the military, so you spent your life serving. And by the way, thank you for your service. Would you not come down on the side of the military in keeping it secret?
I think that I don't think it's of defense significance, okay? I really don't. Let's face it, if anything with that type of technology, if they really wanted to do anything, they sure could have. I don't think they're a threat. I felt that from the first 15 minutes out there. I ascertained it wasn't a threat. And, you know, I believe these are not threats. And I think they've demonstrated over and over. We haven't had anything attacked or anything like that, or anything that has been tampered with, as far as I know. So I really think I wouldn't side with the military on keeping it classified, though. I think they need to go ahead and disclose it.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after these words. Don't go away. Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com.
iPod? Get K-Pods, the Kevin Smith Show podcast, and take Kevin with you everywhere. Subscribe today at kevinsmithshow.com.
Welcome back. We call it the Kevin Smith Show, and I am Kevin Smith, your host. My guest is James Penniston.
You know, James, before we went away for break, I addressed what I think is a critical issue, and that is whether or not these things are a national security threat or any type of a military threat at all. And if they are not, then what's the reason for the secrecy? And that's why I ask you that question. And you said you've been up next to one and touched it. And you did not sense that this thing was a threat at all and posed no national security issue for us. I find it interesting that the military... when they do say something, which is seldom, but when they have said something about these in relation to national security, they've said they pose no national security threat.
Yes, they do. They do say that.
So if there's no national security threat, I don't understand why the secrecy.
I don't have the answer to that, Kevin. I wish I did. Who knows what the inner thinkings? I know everything's departments are very closed on stuff, and I don't think one agency talks to another. And I do believe it's probably a very close guarded secret. As far as I know, I don't even know if presidents know. Maybe they come and go. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that stuff. But I do think that the disclosure is not being unreasonable. I think it's the right thing to do. I think that's what they have to do, and then I think that we can concentrate on the fact of what they are and what they want and things like that.
So what do you think they want?
I don't have the answer to that. I don't know. All I know is that I wasn't harmed, my team wasn't harmed out there, and the base was intact, and nothing was harmed on the base, and we were thankful for that.
Whatever it was, apparently, after it left you, could not report back mission complete or mission accomplished, because it had to come back 3 nights later.
Yeah, apparently their mission wasn't completed. I'll go along with that. That we often talked about that. We couldn't figure out why the second night. The odds are probably astronomical that you'd ever have a craft like that with so many military observers and people as witnesses and so much documentation done. Why would you risk it for a second night in the same location? We don't have the answer to that.
All right, we've got, let's see, 8 minutes left in this show. Let me say to the audience, I will take one more telephone call if you have a question or a comment. And the telephone number is 623-581-5148. Knowing what you know about the symbols that were etched on the side, knowing what you know about that, and understanding where this thing came from, was there anything at all ominous about that?
No, not at all. It's this whole thing is hard to comprehend anyway, Kevin. I mean, from the night out there to the information that we received through research afterwards, I mean, it's mind-boggling. It really is. I'm overwhelmed by it, and I think the other witnesses are too. And all we really want is the same thing you want. We want answers. We can tell you everything that that craft was not. The only thing we can't tell you is what it was.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the telephone line and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
John from San Diego.
Yes, John.
How you doing tonight?
Good.
Hey, first of all, I'd like to say this event that took place in England, I believe this did happen, because it's so obvious that, by the tone of the voice that Mr. Pendleton, is it?
Peniston.
Speaking.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there. There's something there. There's something that happened. And as for why the government is not disclosing this information as this, I may have a bit of information that might help. I don't know. But what happened to us back in 1977 at Fort Benning, what we call this, and what they're still using it as what they call in the military, is camouflage and concealment. And of course the government will deny it. And they're not trying to lie to anybody. They just don't understand what this whole thing is or what it is. So they'll camouflage it and concealment. That's what it's called.
All right.
So it's a bit of an information that I have that might bring into light what's going on at this time.
Okay, John, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you very much, John.
All right. Are you familiar with, I can't remember John's last name. He's been a guest on this show, and I'm thinking his last name is Vasquez. But I could be wrong about that. But he told the story about being at Fort Benning and about there being a UFO incident and about there being a mass abduction of several hundred soldiers. Are you aware of that incident?
No, it's the first I've heard of it. No.
And
Was he at you said Fort Meade?
Fort Benning.
No, that's the first I've heard of that. But, you know, I think that as time goes by, and if you notice, more military, retired military, and people that have been in the military, veterans, are coming more to the front with this type of information. I think the more we talk about it, the more information it gets out. I think it puts pressure on the government to actually disclose some of this information. I think if we do this, the more often we do it, I think there is a better chance for this information to be disclosed by the government. And I think everybody in your listening audience should go ahead and do the same thing. There's some disclosure projects that are working in Washington right now. The Coalition for Disclosure, that's another website they can go to. I think that these are avenues for them to go ahead and get their concerns to our government officials that we need to have this type of information released.
How I hear people predicting that disclosure will take place probably in 2009, 2010. I've heard several people talk about that. What do you think?
I've heard that too. And I tell you what, the conversation I had with John Burroughs last month, we think that there will be around 2010. Because that's one of the subjects that we did talk about.
Why do you think it will happen about 2010? What makes you think so?
Because there's going to be more information that comes out. There's information that they will not be able to deny.
And do you know what that information is?
We believe we know what that is, yes.
And let me ask you this. Is that like earth-shattering information for us?
It's evidence. It's strong.
All right, John, if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of another fantastic edition of the Kevin Smith Show. I wish we had another hour to go, but we don't. John Peniston has been my guest, and it has been my pleasure and privilege to get to talk with him and ask him so many of these questions that have been on my mind since I first heard about this event.
My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.